hungered to know our origins.
Unbelievable. The Saturn V lifting off is awe-inspiring.
And welcome back. It is sunrise on a Tuesday morning, 5th day of August, 2008. My name is Bob Ellis. Dennis Shaughnessy is our co-host this morning.
Good morning.
Reporter, columnist over at the Lowell Sun. Do you like, which role do you like better, reporter or columnist? And wait a minute, let's get that up here.
Well, columnist, I can write about whatever I want to write about. Reporter, I have to.
Well, within reason.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't write about anything.
Yeah. But I mean, as a reporter, I usually get sent out on assignments, or I dig up stories on my own, or find something to investigate.
But as a columnist,
but as
just
a columnist,
spew.
It's just like it's like free. It's just free form writing. It's just
you and Jack Kerouac, your buddy. Oh, wait a minute! I remember he wasn't.
I got a little trouble for that one.
I thought you might. We did ask you a trivia question before. We said which host country's flag typically arrives last, or the host country's flag typically arrives last in the parade of nations that opens each Olympic Games. The question was, at what games did that not happen? Vincent Fish was the first person to correctly answer the question. The answer, Vincent knew that it was Athens 2004 because Greece, the flag of Greece, always enters first.
Makes sense.
Yes, it does. So anyway, congratulations to Vincent Fish from the Haystack Observatory. What are they doing down there? They should be observing.
Yeah, they should be doing what our guest is doing.
And we will get to that.
Talking to you.
We'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, congratulations to Vincent Fish. Wins two tickets to the Lowell Summer Music Series performance by Martin Sexton over at Boarding House Park this coming Saturday evening. All right, a couple of news items I want to relate to you, as this is indeed our Stargazer segment. First, I'm not sure from what this comes, but it may have been a press release. Images from NASA, NASA-funded telescopes aboard a Japanese satellite have shed new light about the sun's magnetic field and the origins of solar wind, which disrupts power grids, satellites, and communications on Earth. Data from, and I think it's pronounced, Hinode, satellite shows that magnetic waves play a critical role in driving the solar winds into space, so on and so forth. Another news item, Sun's corona puts a twist on its pitches. This is from Sky and Telescope. Despite four centuries of telescopic study, we don't fully understand our sun. But the scientists who came to the annual meeting of the Solar Physics Division of the American Astronomical Society, that was held in Maine, Fort Lauderdale, not a bad place to go, are working hard to narrow our knowledge gap. A little bit further down at the meeting, Ed DeLuca of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, which built and runs the XRT, reported that this particular CME, which is coronal mass ejections, I guess solar flares, but we'll find out, started just and so on and so forth. Anyway, joining us live in studio as we look to the heavens this morning from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory is Dr. Ed DeLuca. Ed, good morning. Doctor, welcome.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me go back over a couple of things here. Did I correctly pronounce?
Hinode is Hinode. A reasonable pronunciation.
Okay. I guess this is a multi-nation effort when we're talking about Japanese satellites, NASA-funded telescopes. And
yeah, it's a multi-nation cooperation. It's a Japanese mission. It was the satellite, which is the thing that holds the telescope, was built in Japan. The launch vehicle was a Japanese launch vehicle. It was launched in Japan. There were instruments. We built an X-ray telescope in Cambridge with some collaborators. The Japanese provided the camera that attached to that X-ray telescope. So that our telescope was also a joint collaboration. And there were two other telescopes on board. One is a large visible light telescope. It's called the Solar Optical Telescope. The telescope itself was built in Japan, and instrumentation for that, which is a very complicated set of instrumentation, was built by Lockheed Martin in California. And then there's an EUV and spectrograph, which is also a complicated specialized telescope that was built by a collaboration between the Naval Research Lab in the U.S. and British colleagues in the U.K. So it's three telescopes, several different nations. The Norwegians are providing a large number of ground station contacts, so we can get lots of data down, And it's all being run out of Japan.
So as we go about this, as we take a close look at the sun, are there specific questions that we have in mind that we're looking for answers to? And are we getting those questions answered?
Yes. All of these instruments, when you build a new space research telescope, you have various particular ideas of what you want to do and why it is that you're building these unique instruments, because we don't fly, you know, the same thing over and over again, right? If you're doing operational work, you would fly, you know, you want, you know, to do the same thing, you know exactly what you want, and you get the same data back. We're looking to explore new areas, and so, for example, the Solar Optical Telescope is the highest resolution solar optical telescope ever flown, and putting it above the atmosphere means that you can consistently see the sun very precisely, high resolution, and it's got detailed focal plane instruments that allows you to do the science with that. On the X-ray telescope, again, we have the highest resolution X-ray telescope that's ever flown, and we have greater sensitivity, so we can see fainter things in the X-rays and hotter things in the X-rays than we had with previous telescopes. So, you know, the capabilities are enhanced, and with those enhanced capabilities, you are now able to address these questions like looking at the origin of the solar wind, and you can see for the first time some of these wave processes, which are very hard to detect because the oscillations, things moving back and forth, either in intensity or actual, you know, features moving back and forth, you need very high spatial and temporal resolution to see them, and the spectral capabilities. So, and all of these instruments are designed to sort of work together.
Mm-hmm. As I was reading the article, I mentioned the coronal mass ejection. I assume that's a solar flare?
It's related to a solar flare. Solar flares, in a sort of a phenomenological way of saying there is, you know, a bright explosion on the sun that results in, that is called a solar flare. The mass ejection is also called solar magnetic storms. These are events that are related to solar flares that actually move, blow material off of the sun into interplanetary space. Sometimes they hit the Earth, sometimes they don't, depending on which direction they're going in. And when they hit the Earth, then they have interesting effects on
what are those effects?
Earth. Well, the first thing they do is they hit the Earth's magnetosphere. And the magnetosphere is this, it is a result because the Earth has a magnetic field that's being generated in its core, and it extends out into interplanetary space. The solar wind has a magnetic field, and the two magnetic fields interact. And if the solar wind is just calmly moving by, the magnetosphere has this characteristic teardrop shape. When these solar storms come by, it distorts that, and so you now have shaking magnetic fields. When you have shaking magnetic fields, a basic physical implication of that is it drives electric currents. And one thing it can drive electric currents is in the Earth itself. And that's not a problem if you're sort of a pre-technology society. But if you have long transmission lines or oil pipelines or other things on the ground, suddenly you are now driving electric currents along your power grid, for example, which it really wasn't designed to handle. It's designed to carry, you know, power from the power station to the server. It's not designed to carry these other electric currents. And so one of the classic examples was in 1989, within 90 seconds, the Quebec power grid went down as a result of a solar storm. It happened about 2 a.m. in the morning.
Well, I remember Quebec going down, but I didn't realize that was the result of a solar storm?
Yes. Yeah, in March 1989, it was a large solar storm. It disturbed the magnetosphere. It drove these currents, and it started just tripping off the circuit breakers, and the whole system went down. And so the people who are in that industry, you know, would really like a little warning, because 90 seconds, you know, at 2 in the morning, you can't really, you know, it's hard to respond effectively. But if you had a sense of, well, there's a likelihood to be a solar storm in the next 24 hours, then people could be ready and, you know, and adjust things and be watchful. So nobody likes surprises in you know, in industry and in the,
you know, in some
military
ways, though, there's something reassuring about knowing that we can't control everything yet from Earth.
Yes. There's no question that you're ever going to control anything on the sun, right? All we do is we can, you know, attempt to predict that it's going to happen and characterize what it's going characterize the sort of range of possibilities, and then design to deal with it, either because it'll survive inherently or you will have a be able to respond, turn satellites off and things like that.
How long have you been doing this work in Cambridge?
Well, I came to Cambridge in 1993. Before that, I was at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was at the University of Chicago, and I got my PhD in Colorado. So we've been sort of moving around the country, but nice places all
over. It's a fascinating field, and I just wonder, do you ever get the sense of how insignificant we are as people? Because I'm thinking about these solar flares and these eruptions and everything, and all this is happening, and... You know, I'm in line at Dunkin' Donuts or, you know, waiting for a coffee while all this is occurring in my universe.
Yeah, well, my take on it is first, we're trying to understand what it is that nature's providing us to see. And so it's a, you know, it really is an observer, right? I mean, you're not, there is no sense of control here. You can, you know, when you're doing numerical models, you can sort of tweak things and see, you know, how do systems work, and if you're doing experimental, there's actually a close correlation between some laboratory plasma work that people are doing at MIT and stuff that happens on the sun, and in the laboratory they can move things around, but on the sun all you can do is hope to be in the right place at the right time to see what it is that's going on, and then try to use your physical understanding of the process to say, okay, this must actually be happening. This is why we're suddenly accelerating these large numbers of high-energy particles, which are also another effect of these solar magnetic storms that, you know, if you're sending people into space, you want to know if there are going to be large fluxes of high-energy particles because they have a nasty effect on human life. So, you know, so there are, you know, very practical reasons to try to understand how, you know, when these things are going to occur, and in particular, when these things aren't going to occur. I mean, one of the things NASA really likes is knowing that, you know, there is, you know, it's very unlikely that we're going to have a storm in the next, you know, week or 2 weeks or something like that.
It's kind of solar weather forecasting, if you will. But I just want to understand the process a little bit. When you're on the ground doing this work, are you actually looking at pictures, or is it computer readings that you're getting from, in effect, from the telescope?
Our telescope is very much picture-oriented, and in fact...
So you have to make visual observations.
Yes, the camera sends down digital images, and in fact, the basic sort of unit of an observation is really a movie. It's because the time dependence of these processes are really what's giving you the insight that you need. A single picture can be very pretty, it can be compelling, but it's the movie and how things are changing in time, and the relationship of how what you see changing in time with other observations that give you the physical insight.
So you see an eruption on the sun's surface, or the perimeter.
In the atmosphere.
In the atmosphere. You see this eruption. Are you then looking to see what effects are happening elsewhere between here and there?
Yes. In the last 10 years, we've built up, actually, the solar physics community is sort of integrated better into what we now call heliophysics, which is sort of the sun, the heliosphere, which is interplanetary space, the magnetosphere, and down to the ionosphere. That whole chain of interactions is, there are satellites in all the areas, not perhaps some as many as we would like in some places. So there, you know, yes, when you see something happening on the sun, then you say, okay, can I see it in what we call an in situ measurement, actually a satellite sitting in space and things, the solar wind and this event blows past it. Can I see it at, you know, in the magnetosphere? Do I see auroral observations? And the integration of all of those things is important for us.
This is Sunrise. This is our Stargazer segment. We are talking with Dr. Ed DeLuca from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, talking about, I guess, observations of the sun made in part through the Hinode satellite and the various telescopes on it. Are we seeing things now because of this satellite and the telescopes aboard it that we have never seen before, never been able to get this close a look at? And if we're seeing things we've never seen before, what are we seeing and what are we learning?
Yes, we are. And you always do see things that you've never seen before, so that which is sort of the exciting thing about being in this business. In the X-ray telescope, for example, what we have seen for the first time, these evolution of structures coming out of sunspots, where we can see that there are outflows that we had seen before, but now we can see them better. We can see there are these very common effects called polar jets, and the poles of the sun are unique in some way because they have field lines. Okay, everything in the sun and all of this solar weather that we've been talking about is really driven by magnetic fields. And so we have to sort of take a step back, because people aren't used to the interactions of magnetic fields in daily life, because we live in an atmosphere that is neutral, and that's a good thing. So magnetic fields in our atmosphere just, do not affect the motion of the atmosphere. If you lived in an atmosphere that was ionized, which would be a plasma, like the solar atmosphere, suddenly magnetic fields control everything that's going on, and the interaction between the motion of the plasma and the motion of the magnetic fields is very complicated, and there's great potential for storing energy in them. So in the polar regions of the sun, the magnetic fields open out into interplanetary space. And so the polar regions of the sun, if you look at them in X-rays, often appear dark. They're dark because there's less matter at hot material emitting in X-rays, and there's less matter at hot material emitting in X-rays because the field lines are very long and extend out into interplanetary space. But you also see these very dynamic events where small bits of magnetic field erupt into the polar region and then create these long pencil-like jets that extend into interplanetary space. Those had been seen before with a previous Japanese mission called Yoko. With Hinode, we're able to see them with both much higher spatial and temporal resolution and with much greater sensitivity because the telescope is larger and can see fainter things. And the importance of these jets for the structure of the interplanetary solar wind is being explored right now. So now we're seeing for the first time some of the subtle effects of when these fields change their configuration from being a closed field that's just erupted into this open field. That's called magnetic reconnection. And there are theories related to how that should work. And one of those theories predicts a certain speed at which material is flowing out. And for the first time, we actually have measurements that, tentatively suggest that you can actually see that very fast initial pulse of material going out into the planetary space. So those are the types of new effects that we're seeing. They are related to very detailed physical observations and are giving us insight as to how the physics of that magnetic reconnection process goes on. Now, magnetic reconnection is, if you're not, again, within this neutral atmosphere of the Earth, is something that's very important in the universe, because the universe is largely a plasma and magnetic fields are ubiquitous, and the exchange of energy between the plasma and the magnetic field is mitigated by this reconnection process.
I'm wondering, is what you're trying to explain the fact that as the sun is burning off this energy, it's replenishing itself?
Okay. Yeah. Well, the basic energetics of the sun. Let's talk about that a little bit, because it's worth discussing. There is the source of energy for all of the sun is nuclear burning in the core, right? So in the core of the sun, we're converting hydrogen into helium and producing energy, and that's through a fusion reaction. Take two, hydrogen combines into helium four protons, and so that's where all of the basic energy comes from. Now, once you start having, and it results at a very high temperature, it's 15 million degrees Celsius in the center of the core. And as you move out in the sun, you end up with a situation where the heat is transferred from the lower atmospheres to the higher atmospheres by some process called convection. It's essentially moving gas up and down. And that's moving electrically conducting gas, and moving electrically conducting gas in a rotating system like the sun can generate magnetic fields through something called a dynamo. And for many, many years, actually, my thesis work was done on dynamos, so I can talk extensively about dynamos. But for many, many years, people in the 50s were trying to understand what is the motion in a in this fluid that will allow you to generate a dynamo. Even in the 1950s, I mean, the equations for this were understood back in, you know, Maxwell, you know, wrote down the equations that govern all of these processes back in the, you know, 19th century. But the processes that actually generate magnetic fields is complicated. But you do them ubiquitously. Everywhere in the universe, moving plasmas generate magnetic fields because they're rotating and they have this asymmetrical rotation. So you've got the magnetic fields now, and you know the thing that's driving it ultimately is the core field, but now you're exchanging energy between motion and field, and when that gets out into the corona, which is very very tenuous, the magnetic fields suddenly control. The dominant energy is in the magnetic fields, and the plasma is strongly tied to the magnetic fields. And so where the magnetic fields go, the plasma has to follow.
Hmm. You know, I want to go back to earlier. Dennis had said that he's just some little insignificant guy there at Dunkin' Donuts getting coffee. Accurate, yes. But why does this matter to him? Does this matter to him? Does this make a difference? What goes on in the sun, does it make a difference in Dennis's life?
Well, if it knocks out my power, and you know,
yeah, it didn't happen. Power. That happened once. That was up in Quebec. They were all watching the Canadiens hockey game, and they weren't paying attention to the meters. I mean,
it matters. I mean, if you're in a pre-technological society, which, from our point of view, we can say, you know, before electricity, before radio, the sun really looks like a very constant energy source. You know, this is, you know, why it is that, you know, forever the sun deity was this, you know, steady deity, constant, strong, mm-hmm. you know, reliable. The moon changed faces. It was, you know, a variable, you know, changeable.
Sometimes it wasn't there.
Right, and all that stuff. So, you know, so the sun, you know, the changeability, the variability of the sun is only important if you have a large technological base. So if you know, your daily life depends on things going on like satellites. We were talking about GPS in the previous motion. GPS systems actually can be influenced by solar magnetic storms because of this tenet, you know, the things that are going on the sun actually eventually affect the Earth's ionosphere, and the GPS satellites have to propagate their transmission through the ionosphere. If you have fluctuations in the ionospheric density, you're going to get the transmission times are going to be wrong, and you will have deviations. It's not going to be vital for us mostly, you know, you'll get to your place eventually. If you're, you know, in charge of an aircraft that's coming in on a GPS assisted landing, you really would like to know, you know, 50 feet sort of makes mm-hmm. a difference, right? And so there's circumstances in which that's important. Another thing that's just developed since since the end of the Cold War is these polar high latitude routes from the US to Asia. And those routes are very effective in terms of the shortest distance, and yes. So they're effective for fuel, but you can't fly them if there are solar storms. And so they want to know, because there's radiation environment there that's sort of unpleasant for the mostly for the people who work in the
airline
industry.
Well, I went to Beijing last year. Went over the North Pole, as a matter of fact. So we're at a point now where we can apparently forecast solar storms. Can we forecast first the storm and then when we would feel the effect, and do we get to the point of being able to forecast what that impact will be? How significant is this going to be? A severe impact or minor impact, or is that a ways
off? We're making progress on all of them. I wouldn't say that. I mean, we can identify regions that are likely to create events. We cannot tell you when that solar storm is going to happen, and there is you can make certain educated guesses as to which storms will be what we call geo-effective, are going to hurt, you know, affect things around the Earth's environment, depending on where they occur on the sun. And as you get down the chain, things become, you're sort of accumulating errors as you go along. But you have several hours between, you know, the first initiation and the very high energy particles. You've got about a day and a half before the plasma itself arrives at the Earth. And then downstream of that, so you have time to react, and if you've been, you know, vigilant on these.
Mm-hmm. All right, I hate to say we're out of time. Just getting all revved up.
I am never going to look at the masthead of my newspaper the same way.
Yeah, the sun. Yes.
Good point. Anyway, that's going to wrap up our Stargazer segment. Our thanks, Dr. Ed DeLuca. We thank you very much for joining us. I was going to say it was listed as the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. I've also heard of it as the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Which do you prefer?
The Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics is a parent organization. There's Harvard College Observatory and the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory under it. I get paid by the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory.
Off of Concord Road?
Yeah, between Garden Street and Concord Avenue. Yep.
Dennis, I thought you were just online over there at Dunkin' Donuts. You've been doing some investigative
work. No, I walked into the observatory by accident one time. I was looking for something else.
You thought it was
I was there to pick up a vacuum pump, as a matter of fact.
Well, and I'm not going to ask. I refuse to...
He's building his own spaceship, that's why.
But anyway, Doctor, a pleasure having you with us this morning.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Fascinating stuff. With Dennis Shaughnessy, I'm Bob Ellis. This is Sunrise. You are listening to 91.5.
Throttling down now.
If Einstein heard these results today, he would say, Yahoo!
Looking at the beauty of these things still fills me with wonder.